I'm very pleased to introduce you to Vinay Gupta, who's an old friend of mine, who's a rather extraordinary man of many different talents. Originally a software engineer, worked in the US for a number of years for the Department of Defense, the Rocky Mountain Institute, and all kinds of weird and wonderful places, and has now ended up being, among other things, working for Ethereum, which is one of the companies that are coming out of the whole Bitcoin world. So he's a little bit of an expert on Bitcoin. He's going to tell us more about Bitcoin, which I hope fits logically into the sequence from this morning's talk about payment systems. Vinay, tell us.
Is there a clicker for slides?
No, you're going to have to do it.
Hi, everybody. So I had a look at the slides from this morning. I've got some sense of the stuff you talked about. This is going to be a bit technical, but not horribly, horribly technical. Let's start at the beginning. How many of you have heard of Bitcoin, other than this morning? Okay, good, about half of you. Have any of you actually used Bitcoin? Oh, very good. Should I ask what you did with it? Or no, good. Yeah, right. So, how did you find the experience of using Bitcoin? Was it easy? Was it hard?
So I only used it because I was interested in using it rather than using it for a payment method.
Okay.
Like, it sounded exciting, so I was right.
Yeah.
Rather than investing the time in it. But it was fun.
So you downloaded it or you got a wallet and you bought some Bitcoin and it just kind of worked.
Yeah.
Right. So, Bitcoin. People actually use it. Real people. I'm very glad there was somebody here who had done it. Right. Can't be that hard. Right. Something that people can actually do. Really works. So we are going to go through a bunch of mysterious technical stuff. But at the end of that, you'll have a rough idea of what Bitcoin is, how it works, and what might happen because people are doing stuff with it. This is nothing to do with Bitcoin. This is actually my kind of main project. It's a super simple shelter for refugees. The walls are a whole sheet of plywood just the way it'd come off the truck. The roof triangles are half sheets. So you take a sheet, you cut it on the diagonal like that, you put the pieces together, boom, there's your roof. And the idea is that for refugees, you could just take the wood off the truck and produce enormous amounts of shelter really cheaply. This is a very big hex here, same thing, but this time 45 square meter dome, really large, very useful, all kinds of possible applications. So for me, the reason that I'm particularly fascinated by things like Bitcoin is it gives the long-term possibility of bringing financial services to refugee camps because it's so much cheaper than having things like conventional bank accounts. There's a whole bunch of transformative stuff you can do when the cost of issuing somebody a bank account is nothing and you can do it all on a cell phone. Particularly when you've got populations that are traveling across borders or that are going through dodgy jurisdictions that have hyperinflation, the possibility that refugees could carry their wealth with them in this kind of cryptographic form across borders, through states that have hyperinflation, through states that have currency controls, all of this stuff is very interesting to me. It's still kind of some way in the future, but that is my long-term interest in this kind of topic. And Christopher, do we have a clock somewhere?
Okay.
Ah, great, fabulous. And we've got, what time should I break? 10:10?
Try and finish by about 10:10.
10:10, cool, lovely. So any questions before we wade in? Okay. Right, so Bitcoin. Did you download a wallet or did you use one of the websites? Okay, got it. So you downloaded the entire thing with the whole blockchain, set up the software. Right. So there are lots of different ways of using Bitcoin. You could go to a website and they will hold your money for you and they store it using all the complicated stuff. You can download all the complicated stuff, which is gigabytes and gigabytes of files of transaction history from the beginning of time and code and all the rest of this stuff. Or in between, you can have a cell phone app. You download it, gives you the ability to make a new account. Click the button, Bob's your uncle, you get a new account. The account has a long account name, which looks like a Wi-Fi login. You know, AFD16, yada, 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 yada. that's your account. You make a new one, you just hit button, new account, they all come up at zero balance. To get some Bitcoin, in the old days, you could have set your computer to do a bunch of computation and they would have given you some, kind of as a reward. These days, you have to buy it. So you go to a website, you give them your credit card, they give you some Bitcoin, or there are websites where you could basically make an arrangement to meet somebody in a pub, you get out your cell phone, they get out their cell phone, you literally take a photograph of the barcode on their phone, on your phone, and that's how the value is transferred. Sounds absolutely bonkers, actually works, people are really doing it. How did you get your Bitcoin? Did you buy it online?
Got it.
So that kind of thing of you just download an app and it gives you a bank account, it doesn't actually sound very complicated. And it's not actually very complicated. You can just go to a website, log in, make an account, boom, there you go. But on the back end, making a system like that secure and global turns out to take some real work. So this system started when an anonymous guy by the name of Satoshi Nakamoto uploaded a bunch of software to the internet. And the software was a Bitcoin client. It's a chunk of code that you run on a laptop that had all of the stuff necessary to connect to all of the other machines that were also running the same software and turn them into a unified cooperative network that produced the Bitcoin currency. So there was no central server, there was no data warehouse, there was no Amazon Web Services, there was no .com. It was literally just a bunch of code that you downloaded and ran, and the output of all of the machines that were running that software together was a currency. The clever thing about that is that it is fraud resistant, and we're going to talk a lot about how it was made fraud resistant. But the fact that you could get a fraud-resistant currency out of a bunch of people running a chunk of software on their laptops is sort of the magic of Bitcoin. That is where the magic is, and it's extraordinarily odd that you could get that to happen at all. It's a weird thing. We've discussed a little bit about how you get hold of the stuff. People will sell it to you. There are companies providing wallets. There are lots of people doing companies that will accept Bitcoin for services. Often they will proxy, so you want to buy something from Amazon, you can pay somebody in Bitcoin, they'll buy it from Amazon in cash and then ship it to you. Lots of different things are going on. Any questions about that stuff? Okay. So, we're now going to talk about how Bitcoin is made. Has anybody heard the term Bitcoin mining? Okay, a few people. So what we're going to talk about is not the super detailed level of how it's mined and what they're doing, not a kind of code level, but conceptually one level above that. We're going to try and answer the question in general terms, how do I take a piece of software that's running on everybody's laptop in this room and get that to produce a fraud-resistant currency? Because that does kind of sound a little magic, doesn't it? Something very clever is being done there. So there are four things that are being done. One is proof of work, two is digital signatures, third is chained hashes, four is Byzantine consensus. So just headline level, proof of work is I give you a problem to solve, you solve the problem, you give me back the results, I can quickly, cheaply check that the result is accurate. Simple enough, right? Digital signatures, does anybody know what a digital signature is? Yeah? Okay. So digital signatures are a way of proving that somebody else knows something. And if you could prove that somebody else knows something and only one person in the world knows that thing, then you can prove it's them. So an example of this is passwords, right? We all use passwords all the time, but for you to log into a computer, you have to give it your password. A digital signature is a way of letting you log into a computer by proving that you know your password, but without ever showing it to them. So a simple way of doing that, if you imagine that your password was a paragraph of text, I might say to you, right, what's the third word? Okay, what's the ninth word? What's the 15th word? And by doing that, you could verify that you and I had the same secret without me ever showing it to you. We could do it kind of a piece at a time. Digital signatures are another step beyond that, and I'll get into the detail in a second, but you're using them all the time already. You know HTTPS, right? HTTPS works on digital signatures. Amazon has proven to your web browser that it is who it says it is using this thing called a digital signature. So you're using them already. Chained hashes are a way of having documents which are versioned, and every version of the document contains a proof of all the versions of the document that it was descended from. So it's kind of like including the total history of something in the thing itself. And then finally, Byzantine consensus is essentially democracy for computers. So, and we're going to go through these steps in a little more detail, but conceptually, Bitcoin is what happens when you take those four things and you put them together in a really clever way. Right, so we're going to go through this, and at the end of that, you should have a kind of arm-waving knowledge of what Bitcoin is and how the hell it was made. Right. So, proof of work is the first kind of core concept in Bitcoin. The hard problem that they're using to prove that your computer is doing hard work is called a hash. And a hash is essentially a way of taking an arbitrarily large file and bashing it down to a string that looks kind of like a Wi-Fi login, right? 40 characters of AF1B469, blah, 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 blah. The same file will always produce the same hash. And these things are used all over the place. BitTorrent? Has anybody seen BitTorrent? Right?
No, nobody's
seen BitTorrent. Yeah, right. So BitTorrent works with using file hashes, right? If you're downloading magnet links and stuff like that, every now and again you'll see these kind of long strings of magic numbers, right? That's a hash. And the reason that you know you're downloading this file rather than that file is because the hash matches the thing. So if you've got a 5 gig file and I've got a 5 gig file and we want to compare them, if we're going to send the bytes over the network, we have to transfer 5 gig, and that's going to take a month. So instead, you compute the hash of your file, I compute the hash of my file. If the hashes are the same, we know they're the same file, we don't have to send anything. And BitTorrent uses that, so it doesn't send you the bits of the file you've already got, it only sends you new stuff. Useful things, right? Used everywhere. Dead useful. So the way that Bitcoin works is essentially it gives you a file and says, find me another file that has the same hash as this file for the first 5 digits. So you then have to go and test enormous numbers of random files until you find two things where the hash matches, and then you come back and you show me, here's the file you gave me, here's the file I found that matches it, these two things match, I had to work really hard to do that. Simple enough, right? So if I give you a really hard problem like that, you might tie up your laptop for 6 months searching for that hash, and you come back, that thing is now valuable, because if somebody else wants to replicate that, it's going to take them 6 months of laptop time to do it. So it's a cheap way of proving that somebody spent a bunch of time doing a bunch of work. Now, the Bitcoin guys come along, and as soon as they get started on this, people begin to design custom hardware to do this process faster. Right? Has anybody seen pictures in the news of like Bitcoin mines? These huge rooms filled with computers just crunching away? So that's what they're doing. They're looking for hashes. Right now, because hashing is kind of a specialized computational thing, if you design a custom machine to do it, it will go enormously faster than your laptop, like 10,000 times faster. The hash mines are now capable of hashing stuff, because they're super specialized, something like 500 times faster than the fastest supercomputer in the world. Right? Enormous, enormous amounts of computer power being burned, huge amounts of electricity. A lot of the mining is done using stolen electricity. So people are basically building these, you know, huge computer labs, you know, round the back of some factory where they've just kind of run a pipe out the back of like an aluminium smelting plant. It's a very peculiar situation. That's what's happening. Final thing I should mention. The reason Bitcoin is so secure is that you can't do a fraudulent transaction on Bitcoin. You can't basically fake something unless you redo all of the work that's been done from the beginning of time on Bitcoin. So you've now got years and years and years and years and years of accumulated computation piled up into this unbelievably large amount of work that's been done, and the proof that that work has been done would have to be faked by redoing all of it. And it's just impossible. Pretty much. So, digital signatures, right? We talked about these briefly. You generate a secret on your computer, right? Actually, I should ask a question. PGP or GPG, anybody heard of this? Secure email? All right, okay. So, think when you generate...
Actually, you was doing a legal step on my chain, not here, what
if it? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that. So, when you have a digital signature, it's like making up a password. But the password that you're making up is something like 5 pages long. So you don't do it yourself, you have a computer do it. And the password has a special form, which is it's basically two prime numbers multiplied by each other. So you've got like a 200-digit prime and another 200-digit prime, and you multiply them together and you use this as a password. But it's a special kind of password because of a whole bunch of advanced mathematics. It will let you log into a remote machine without ever showing your password. So you do something which is kind of sort of like a hash, but different math. And instead of giving you my password, I give you that kind of special thing that I've computed. And that's a digital signature. So when you log into, say, Amazon, you've got on your web browser a thing called a certificate. And the certificate is a digital signature that proves the machine you're connecting to is Amazon. And the machine on the other end that you connect to has to basically verify that it is who it says it is to your machine. And this is quite technical. I mean, this stuff was only invented in the 1970s and wasn't widely adopted until 1999. So if it seems a bit vague, it is actually damn near cutting edge. But what it allows you to do is prove your identity because you're the only person that has this enormous password. And when somebody challenges me to prove it, I could do something which proves that it's me, but without giving away the secret so now they can copy it. Does that kind of make sense?
You kind of, I have something there, and when I'm trying to pay something online, Amazon will ask me for my own code, but it won't ask me the whole code. It'll be like, give me the first, third, fourth digit of your code.
Yeah.
Not even my pen, just like an extra pen.
Yeah. It's exactly that kind of thing, but super secure, and it's only done machine to machine. So it's tons of math to make it verify. Now, what that gives you is this ability to have an identity that's stable. So you've got a digital identity. It allows you to log into computers. It allows you to sign documents. So I get a document. I do some math on the document. I generate a thing at the bottom, and I'm the only person that can generate that thing, and anybody can verify that I'm the only person that could have said that. That's a digital signature. These were major discoveries in computer science when they were invented. And they're everywhere. E-commerce doesn't work without digital signatures. So Bitcoin has this proof of work thing. And then to prove that you are the person that did the work, you put your digital signature on the proof of work. That's not too bad, is it? Digital signature on a proof of work? Does everybody feel basically comfortable that they could arm wave their way through that in the pub?
One question.
Yes.
The bank obviously knows your password to verify that what you sent them is right. How does that work?
Okay. So, with this whole digital signature business, actually, there isn't one thing, there are two things. So, there's a secret thing that you generate on your own computer, which is like your private password, and it's pages long, and it's never revealed. From that, you generate a thing called a public key. So, the public key is mathematically related to your secret, and you can give the public key to somebody. Now, this part sounds like magic. It is. If I've got your public key, I can take a message, I can encrypt it using your public key, and I can send it to you. You are now the only person that can decrypt it.
Yeah.
And this ability to have a code where the key to decrypt it was different from the key to encrypt it was unbelievably revolutionary at the time. It took everything we knew from the, you know, 2,000 year history of ciphers and went, thump, pancaked it over. How it works, long explanations on the internet, there are videos, there must be 50 different ways of explaining it. I'm not going to try and wade through any of them, but the bottom line is that it works because multiplying numbers is a lot easier than dividing them. Yeah, at the back? Say again? Yeah, we're talking about RSA. Bitcoin doesn't use RSA, it uses elliptic curves, which are a bit more compact, the signatures are smaller, but it's all that family of algorithms, RSA, DSA, elliptic curve, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, exactly. Okay, right, we've armed our way through that to the next part. Chained hashes. Now, remember our old friend, this hash function from proof of work? Right, so if I take a document and then I sign the bottom of it, that document can now have a hash, which proves that you and I have the same document. Not too bad. If I then make a new version of the document, I can clearly indicate that it's descended from this other document by taking the hash of this document, which is only yay long, and putting it in this document, and then I put a digital signature on all of that, and then I take the hash of that. And then I do it again and again and again. So I can wind up with a document that's got a hash of a hash of a hash of a hash, which proves this document came from this document, came from this document, came from this document, came from this document. And if somebody goes back into that history and alters one of those documents, we can prove that the document has been altered because of this thing called a chained hash. Now, if every step on that chain also happened to take a month of computer time to prepare, by the time we've got this document, and it's got links to all of these prior documents, what you've got is a document that proves that somebody did 6 months of computation, one step at a time. And that document then becomes a very expensive thing to forge, particularly if you're going to try and forge it quickly. Does this kind of make sense? Right? Layer by layer by layer by layer, we're building up to unforgeable stuff that works like money. First the proof of work, then the digital signature, then the chained hash. Right? Not too far to go. Right, Byzantine consensus, not so bad. All of us have computers, all of the computers are running the Bitcoin thing, they're all beavering away doing the work. When you get a result, you publish it to all the other computers and say, I am Bob, I did this first. Most of the other computers are run by honest people. They put a signature on it that says, I saw Bob say that he did this first. I agree that Bob won that round. If all of the computers come to the same result and everybody agrees that Bob did it, Bob gets a Bitcoin. Bing! Right. Now, if some of the computers are being run by con men who want to steal Bob's work, as long as there are less con men than honest citizens, the honest citizens will put their digital signatures onto the proof of work, verifying that Bob should get the reward. And the ones who tried the fraudulent approach will not get anything for their work. So unless more than half of the people involved are con men, Bitcoin will produce an actual reward for work done. That wasn't too bad, was it? I know, it all seems like magic. Let's go back. There we are. So, proof of work, you make your computer work very hard, and then you prove to other people you did it. Digital signatures, you sign the proof of work so that it's you that makes the claim you did it. Chained hashes, the proofs of work all connect to each other, so you wind up with this enormous amount of computation that nobody can fake. Byzantine consensus, we all agree who gets the reward for the work done. Does any single step in that seem ridiculous? Okay, so part of the way that Bitcoin does this is it doesn't have a general clock. So not all the machines agree when in time we are, which protects you from all kinds of attack. All the machines agree on is what we have seen so far. So You see it, you publish the fact that you saw it. If you saw it before I saw it, we might disagree about who was first. And this is where the Byzantine tolerance comes in. So everybody's attempting to publish the stuff as quickly as possible to make sure that they're not going to get ripped. But unless 51% of people are ripping them, they're still going to get the claim in first.
But there's only one hash being decided at a time.
Well.
Because if there were two and they both didn't simultaneously, so how would they, who would decide which chain?
So welcome to the rabbit hole. So, So the first thing is that you're very seldom going to see two people computing the same hash. It's like 1 in 4 billion. In the event that you do, Bitcoin will basically take the hack, which is people will decide at random who was first and then just go with it. And that's the general approach. Generally speaking, when Bitcoin hits a situation which appears to be undecidable, it will just randomly pick one consistent model of reality and go with it. And what happened on the other branch will be randomly dropped. I'm fairly sure this has never actually happened in practice, but in theory it will just roll over. Now, in practice, I mean, we can talk about cartels and so on, but that's another story. Right. So, we've gotten some sense of these kind of atomic building blocks, right? What you get out of that when you've assembled these building blocks in the correct way is essentially an Excel document which will only allow you to add lines. So all of this enormously labyrinthine computing and all the rest of this malarkey, what it gets you is basically a big old spreadsheet, and all you could do is you could add a line, and once the line has been added, it can never be edited. In computer science, they call that append only. So you could just add a line, and add a line, and add a line, and add a line, and you can never take back anything that's been said. And everybody will agree on the status of that document at any time. Anybody use Google Docs? Right? So essentially, Bitcoin is like a super high security Google spreadsheet that everybody is sharing. And the rule is, once you've put a new line at the bottom, you can't edit it. So I put a line at the bottom, and we know that it's me because of this whole digital signature thing. So I digitally sign a line that says, I give Christopher 1 Bitcoin. Boom. That statement is the Bitcoin being transferred. So he doesn't need to do anything at all. I have stated I'm giving it to him. It's with him because when we look, we can see it's with him. Christopher then signs a line that says, you're giving it to randomly pick someone. You, right? So now, right, the Bitcoin can be seen to have come from me to Christopher to you. And the fact that each one of us signs the transfer order that gives it to somebody else is the transfer. So when I can show that this Bitcoin originated here, was transferred 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 here, was given to him, given to her, given to him, given to her, that transfer history is the Bitcoin.
Can the recipient reject? Can the recipient reject?
No, not as far as I know. We don't want your stupid money. No, I am pretty sure that the recipient is passive, because it's just going into the blockchain. It's not going to you getting signed and then being put in the blockchain. There are things, there's a system called Ricardo by a guy called Ian Grigg, who's a friend of mine, that allows recipients to reject, but it has a centralized server. And there are reasons why you want centralization sometimes, decentralization other times. Now, is there any real lack of clarity about this idea that Bitcoin is basically just a gigantic shared Excel spreadsheet with digital signatures? Right? Yeah?
Could you then track who gave Bitcoin to you? So I thought Bitcoin was going to be anonymous.
Splendid question. Yes, you can track exactly who gave Bitcoin to who. But remember I said you could push a button and make a new account? So you can track a Bitcoin to see which accounts that it went to. The hard part is mapping the account to a person. So if you had, Bitcoin running an internet cafe, running over Tor, you could get into a position where it was very, very hard to map a given individual to a given Bitcoin account. But everybody can see all the transactions that go in and out of any specific Bitcoin account. And there are things like Is it worth explaining that? Yeah. So there are some people that want an audit trail for their financial transactions. So they'll kind of publicly verify they have only one Bitcoin account. It's got this, this is the human being that's associated with the account. They'll bind it to their real identity as close as possible. You can never prove that they don't also have a secret account. So it's possible to prove that this person owns that account. It's not possible to prove they don't own any other accounts. And that's why you get so much weird stuff happening in the Bitcoin world, because you can always see the history of an account, but you can never tell how that relates to other people. And this is particularly tricky because think of things like securities fraud and insider trading. So if you are a random person on the internet, it's legal for you to do this thing. If I am the CEO of the company, it's illegal for me to do it. So when you create an anonymous system like Bitcoin, one of the problems that you have is that people will do things which are legal if they're done by a stranger, but are illegal if they're done by an insider. And that's one of the reasons that, for example, the SEC is freaking out about Bitcoin. Yeah? Any other questions? No? Okay. So this notion that we've got this, you know, giant shared Excel spreadsheet, that is supported by enormous amounts of technical gubbins, right? And we've taken a little tour through the technical gubbins, but at the end of the day, if all you remember about Bitcoin is it's a gigantic, secure Excel spreadsheet that you can never edit, you can only add to, you will understand all of the deeply significant stuff about it. Right. Let's move forward. So what this gives us is the central bank of the internet. Now, somebody else could start another central bank of the internet using similar software, and it could become even bigger. So it's probably safer to say it's a central bank of the internet than the central bank, but it is literally a central bank. The internet is sitting there generating money based on doing crazy amounts of computational work, and that money is secure enough and reliable enough that to this date, nobody has managed to hack Bitcoin. They've managed to hack each other's accounts by basically breaking into computers and stealing passwords, but they've never managed an attack on the main system that succeeded. And this is properly crazy. Like, when you actually think about that, bunch of guys write a bunch of software, 2008 they get started, 2010 it begins to pick up momentum, boom, 4 years later it's a central bank. Does that seem kind of completely off the hook? Or is that just that I'm getting old? Right? I mean, this is a genuinely weird thing. The impact of that in the long run is potentially going to be as large as the invention of the web. So we had computer networks before the web browser was invented. You could send email, you could FTP files, you could play multi-user dungeons, you could have chat. There were forums where people discussed. But there was no kind of nice, pretty interface. You couldn't publish documents easily. It was just this kind of, you know, it was a bit of a curiosity. It was really useful for some people. Never spread outside of academia, really. Bit of business and research labs. Then Tim Berners-Lee makes this thing called a web browser because he wants the internet to be easier to use. Now everybody looks at the internet and sees the web. It's become a layer that's on top of everything else with computers. Bitcoin basically gives you something that kind of works like the web, but now you can make payments on it. So rather than going to a computer, fishing around your pocket, taking out a credit card, putting it in front of a screen, typing in your little numbers, and having the transaction kind of go from the world of credit cards to the world of the web, and having that bridge be built manually by you typing in your bloody numbers, or your credit card being stored by Amazon for you, instead, you kind of stay inside of the internet, but now the internet does payments too. And it's born on the internet, it lives on the internet, it's spent on the internet, it's circulated on the internet, it really is internet money. And we're at the very earliest steps of figuring out what that looks like. You know, if you've got a credit card in your pocket, if you've got a bank account, it's not that big a deal to have another bank account that only exists on the internet and that exists with magical funny money, right? But if you're one of the billions of people in the world that doesn't have a bank account because you don't have a strong enough government-issued identity to give you a bank account, the ability to basically get a smartphone for $40, get, you know, 2 rupees worth of 3G access, and then get a Bitcoin wallet, boom, suddenly we have banking for the poor, outside of the control of any nation state. This is remarkable and dramatic, right? Billions of people might discover that their first access to the financial system is Bitcoin, and their ability to do international currency transfers is massive without any real government oversight. Does anybody begin to see that there might be some implications to this? Right? You know, JRandom Hacker, the anonymous Satoshi Nakamoto, sits there and bangs out something that might actually be the world's most widely used currency within 5 years. Right? I mean, you know, Chinese yuan is probably the world's most widely used currency. It's got about, what, 1.5 billion users? You could talk about all the extraterritorial dollars in circulation. That's a lot of money. But in terms of the actual number of people that are capable of taking a payment, it's not at all unreasonable, but by the time all the poor people have smartphones, which is coming very quickly, it will be a standard feature of a smartphone to be able to buy and sell Bitcoin using it. All the poor people in the world with international payment infrastructure. Oh my God. Big deal. Right. So, this notion that you've got shared history and that that shared history is a global asset, it's very much the same kind of conceptual structure as Wikipedia. Wikipedia is kind of like a shared global knowledge asset. Bitcoin is like a shared history of value transfer. Right? Something about the internet seems to generate these single unitary shared public resources that have enormous global power. I'm going to pause here for a second to take a couple of questions and then we'll do a little bit more. So, any questions about the technical stuff? Yeah?
Is there not a finite number of Bitcoins that can be mined?
Yes.
What implications do you think that might have?
Okay. So, the question is, aren't there a finite number of Bitcoins that can be mined? Yes. So, the process by which Bitcoins are created gets harder and harder and harder and harder until it becomes impossibly difficult. The reason they did that was to stop inflation. As a result, they've got deflation. I seem to remember that about half of the Bitcoins that can be created have been created. And the expectation is that they'll be all mined out by 2030-something. Is that about right? To be brutally honest, I don't think that Bitcoin in its current form will survive long enough for us to run out of Bitcoins. There's so much other activity going on in this kind of area that I think 5-10 years out, what you're going to discover is that other people are doing things that are more successful than Bitcoin. The value transfer of Bitcoin into those systems will probably be that people will sell Bitcoin or buy other currencies. There are several things about the initial design of Bitcoin that I think, with the benefit of hindsight, we can now say were mistakes. And the permanent cap on the number of Bitcoins is probably one of those. But, you know, it's not that, you know, these are not dumb mistakes. These are experimental discoveries, right? So, yes, the rocket blew up, but we now know that hydrazine is not an appropriate fuel. I think that the long-term consensus will be that having a limit to mining in that way is not actually viable in the long run. But I could be wrong. Only time will tell. It is expected that Bitcoin will continue to rise in value because of the limited supply. I think in practice that is probably true. But Bitcoin's real competitor is not cash, it's the successors to Bitcoin. Okay, any more questions about the technical stuff? Yeah.
Who is gaining from the whole process? Like, so when you're creating hashes or doing the mining,
yes.
Like, that's creating a Bitcoin, but why? Like, where's the...
Who gets paid?
Yeah.
Right. So, I mentioned that you have these kind of supercomputer level resources required to make a Bitcoin. Those supercomputer level resources are owned now by essentially mining cartels. So bunches of people that put up millions of dollars up front to build supercomputers that then get the Bitcoin. It's an amazing thing. Right? Now, the mining cartels are mysterious. They're pretty anonymous. It's not really clear who they are. They're often quite sketchy. But what they're doing is they're selling the Bitcoin for cash into the Bitcoin economy, and then the Bitcoin is circulating. So the majority of the Bitcoin around is not just being mined, it's actually mined a long time ago and then bought and sold.
But the actual process of what they're doing in order to earn that first Bitcoin, who does that benefit?
Actually, it just benefits the miners. So the people that spent all this money to build the supercomputers are the ones that benefit from the mining process.
So there's no real point to the actual mining process except to say I did it.
Yes, exactly.
The
completely pointless.
It is
completely pointless. Now, this raises an interesting question. So proof of work is a heavy concept in computer science. It's been kicked around for quite a long time. There are two ways of looking at it. You can do proof of work on something which is actually useful, but then there's a second reason for doing all of that work. So you're essentially subsidizing your mining process. So if I wanted to do, for example, protein folding, right? If I wanted to protein fold anyway, then I'm basically going to have a computer, it's going to do protein folding, I'm going to get money for free. On the other hand, if I wanted to just get the money, I have to do all this protein folding work to get it. So actually turning this whole kind of Bitcoin thing into an enormous protein folding sort of science lab might have been a really good idea. And this is another one of these design questions where could you do something like Bitcoin, but it gave us an enormous protein folding armory? That might actually be a great way of doing it. But right now, it's just turning electricity into money. Okay, one more question on the tech. Anybody want to know anything?
So if you do any studies into the fact that the cartels are actually just mining coins for actual currency? Because technically, the miners sell Bitcoin back for real cash, dollars or pounds.
Yes, absolutely.
So you're creating an economy for other people by making yourself richer.
Yeah.
Is there any sort of ethics around that, or does any government say this is wrong?
At this point, the majority of the focus of governments on Bitcoin is not about Bitcoin mining. Right. That's not, generally speaking, where the rubber meets the road on this stuff. It's Silk Road, which is where the action is. How are we doing for time? Maybe another 5 minutes. Right. I'll take one or two questions about the kind of impact on the third world banking, unbanking thing. Then I'm going to crack through another couple of slides. Going once, going twice. Right, onwards. So, value of Bitcoin. Historically, started out as essentially having no value. It was something like 3 cents a coin. At peak, it was about $1,000 a coin, representing nearly a 2,000% rise. I strongly considered buying here and decided not to. I just don't do speculative finance. Like, I don't do stock markets, I don't do gambling. That's my personal ethics. I looked at this and said it was basically like shooting fish at a barrel. It was dirty money. Probably I should have taken it. How much is it worth? Currently, $4 billion. Wow, right? Bunch of guys, bunch of software, $4 billion. Right? Now, that's not all sitting in one pocket. That's the total volume of money in the entire system, but it's a lot of money, awful lot of money. But remember, it's like a commodity. So if everybody tries to sell their Bitcoin at once, the price of Bitcoin will fall to basically nothing. So you can't actually turn $4 billion of Bitcoin into $4 billion of cash. It's subject to the volume of transactions the market will support and all the rest of this kind of stuff, right? But in the current equilibrium, $4 billion, reasonable amounts of volume. Pulled out of thin air. Amazing. It is the first time that I've ever seen political activists with money. All of those kind of hackery types, cypherpunks, all the rest of that, you know, clickety, 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 clickety. Nobody ever really had any cash unless they got day jobs and then they got bored and went mad. Suddenly, activists running around with $500,000 in the bank because they started mining Bitcoin in spring of 2009. Crazy. Weird things are happening. All the Wall Street boys are coming along, retail stores. There are lots of places in, for example, Berlin, where you can pay for coffee and beer in Bitcoin.
You bring up a phone, the phone has a barcode on it, they scan the barcode, transactions happen, payments are made. I'm currently working for these guys called Ethereum. So they're taking this notion of a blockchain with all this immutable stuff on it, and instead of just having an Excel spreadsheet where you're just transferring value from one account to another, they're putting in contracts. If this amount is greater than this amount, give the Bitcoin to Fred. If it is less than that amount, give the Bitcoin to Harry. Only instead of Bitcoins, it can be the contents of other contracts. So what this gives you is the ability to do things which look like joint stock companies, but they only exist inside of a blockchain. Lots of computers doing lots of computation, storing lots of value, not just in the form of cash, but in the form of share ownership, contracts, futures, and all other kinds of craziness. Do you think anybody understands what's going to happen to the world if that actually works? Because we sure don't. We have no idea. Right. I mean, we expect it to be something amazing, but the ability to put contracts into this global jurisdiction in a manner that doesn't let anybody repudiate what they said they would do, that has never existed before. Contracts have always existed relative to a nation state that we do enforcement. Right? This contract will be heard under English law. If you want to get the contract enforced, you have to go to the English legal system. If the contract is sitting on a computer and it's a piece of code, everybody runs the code, agrees on what the output of the code was, and that in itself becomes the output of the contract. Does that sound slightly crazy? Piece of software on the internet that is a contract that runs our software, and that we all agree that if the output is the same for all of us, that was the conclusion of the contract. Futures, covered calls, you name it, financial instruments, and other things. Other things you could do, right? Tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of little currencies. Download the Bitcoin source code, make some changes, run a new currency. Generally speaking, they're all tiny. There are lots of them. I mentioned the activists. Illegitimate uses. Silk Road, right? Heard of Silk Road? Right. So, eBay for drugs, guns, unicorn horns, bits of moon rock, whatever it happens to be. Hugely exaggerated scare stories. Actually, if anything, it's made people safer because they're less likely to get shot dealing drugs. On the other hand, it's probably increased the availability of illegal things. In actual fact, it's probably a ton easier to police than a lot of other things that were happening were, because it seems that actually the police have been pretty effective in arresting the people running these things. Witness the Dread Pirate Roberts, who went down very hard, and I think that's happened to two or three other people doing this stuff. So although there's a lot of screaming about this stuff being anonymous and untrackable and all the rest of it, in practice it was probably a lot harder to catch Pablo Escobar than a bunch of guys who are still connected to computers which eventually you can track.
Do you really believe that?
Yeah, I do. Everybody who's doing this kind of stuff in a high profile way becomes a target for surveillance by groups like the NSA or the CIA. And if you think about what we know from the Snowden documents about how much control of the internet the NSA actually has, the notion that you can hide anything from the government on the internet is highly questionable. So it may be that local law enforcement doesn't have the technical capabilities to figure out who's who, but you can be damn sure the NSA does.
But if you put the NSA to Pablo Escobar, I don't find it. So we're not comparing policemen versus the NSA.
Well, finding Escobar was not the hard part. The hard part was that you needed an army to go and get him. And that is not so true for the Dread Pirate Roberts, who is some kid living in a suburban house in California, right? So these guys are very, very clever at hiding on the internet, but the internet actually belongs to the state. So at that point, the notion that it's this kind of anonymous global resistance and all the rest of that, it's probably just that the NSA can't be arsed to go over there and get them. Do you really want that guy badly enough? I mean, are we supposed to care about this? All right, well, if you insist, yeah, his name is Fred and he's at this address. I mean, there's a lot of very sketchy stuff about how the Dread Pirate Roberts was arrested. The official story of how they found him sounds a little weak. To me, I look at that and I think this is probably a case where military intelligence handed somebody a street address. But there's no way to know. The point is only, there is an enormous amount of hype and exaggeration about, oh my God, it's the end of the ability to police these things. no, it might be the end of the local constabulary's ability to police these things, but the people that police the internet are perfectly capable of doing their jobs. Right. So, other things you can do with this kind of blockchain technology. Any place that you've got a space of names, right? Street addresses, phone numbers, email addresses, website addresses, property rights registers, anything along those kind of lines, eventually could be replaced with blockchains, right? So dog registries, right? Records of who won Olympic events, race times for marathon runners, anything where you want a permanent fact stored, anything where you want to say, I discovered this, this is mine, patent, copyright, all of this kind of stuff could eventually be done with blockchains. How much of that stuff it will be sensible to do with blockchains is an open question. We don't know yet. Maybe everything, maybe almost nothing. Ongoing topic of examination. I think that's the last slide. No, there we go. That's the last one. Real world things. So, you know, we could track this from before the point of manufacture. So here's a trade for a bunch of aluminium ore. Here's a smelter. Here is it being turned into 100,000 cans. Here is the can being transferred to a canning factory. Here's the canning factory filling it with the substance. There's the audit trail for the substance. Here is it being put on a truck. Here is it being shipped. Here is it being bought by me. On the bottom, there's a little 2D barcode. And if I punch it into a computer, it shows me the whole audit trail of the object. That sounds pretty damn useful to me. There's an outfit working on that kind of stuff in London called Provenance, Twitter handle Provenance HQ. You could take all the stuff that we need in terms of environmental accounting and environmental audits, and if you do the transfer of material goods on blockchains, it means it's possible to track the entire history right back to the point where somebody was paid for digging the metal out of the ground with a shovel. Now, that's a lot of computer power, right? It's so much more computer power than just storing that stuff in Excel spreadsheets or databases. It might be an absurd amount of computer power. On the other hand, we might be able to design low energy consumption blockchains, in which case we could have permanent records of all of this material stuff that we're doing, which would give us a real handle on both human rights abuses in the manufacturing system and also on environmental impact. Potentially a big deal. Same thing for art. What it all boils down to is record keeping is becoming something that you don't need the government to back up. Public records that are actually maintained by the public. Where that will go, nobody knows. But previous constructs were things like newspaper of record. Right? Used to talk about the New York Times and the London Times as the newspaper of record. If it was happened and it was real and it mattered, it would be in the Times. If you went back 50 years later and the Times said it had happened, it happened. Fantastic function. Libraries, British Library, it's a copyright library, you send it a copy of everything you've done. Permanent storage. Potentially could be done the same way. So, sorry I'm a little over time. Any last questions? Yes?
How do the people that found it make
money? Say again?
How do the people that actually found the Bitcoin make money?
We don't know.
Can they take any Bitcoins themselves?
We don't know who founded Bitcoin, right? In the early days, Bitcoin and mining was super simple, so you could do it on a laptop. And the record shows there was a ton of Bitcoin mining done very early on. So we assume that the early founders of Bitcoin mined tons of Bitcoin, and that was their kind of stake in it. However, correct me if I'm wrong about this, my understanding is that almost none of the Bitcoin that was mined in the very early days has ever been spent. So there's an enormous amount of Bitcoin sitting in these mammoth accounts, which go back to 2008, 2009, which have never been touched. So is it on some laptop that got thrown in a landfill? Is it that somebody's sitting there and they don't want to spend it because it will collapse the market? Was it just lost? We don't know. Anonymous, sketchy, mysterious. $4 billion of value created by a bunch of people that we can't even find. This is really science fiction stuff.
Okay, anything else? Okay, I'll be here a little while after. Thank you.